Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry.
It was a pleasure to welcome Chris Trumar, founder and CIO of Goose Hollow Capital, back to the Alpha Exchange. Chris presents a compelling argument that traditional economic frameworks centered on consumption are becoming obsolete as AI-driven CapEx emerges as the dominant growth engine. With companies spending $400 billion annually on AI infrastructure, he contends we're witnessing a fundamental shift from consumption-led to investment-led economic dynamics, requiring investors to recalibrate how they analyze market drivers and policy transmission mechanisms. Chris draws parallels between current AI investment patterns and historical tech bubbles, noting critical differences in financing structures that could alter unwind scenarios. He explores the unique challenges facing monetary policymakers as AI disrupts labor markets, while tariff policies create inflationary pressures, potentially rendering traditional Fed tools less effective. The discussion also covers emerging market opportunities, particularly in Latin America, where countries benefit from AI-related commodity demand while offering superior real interest rates. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Chris Kumar.
My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Chris Kumar. He is the founder and CIO of Goose Hollow Capital, a global macro fund that also has a couple of ETFs in its suite. Chris, it's wonderful to welcome you back to the Alpha Exchange.
Thanks, Dean. I'm really excited to join you again. Really enjoyed our conversation last time and looking forward to this.
Well, you are a very active thinker on all things macro. So I'm truly looking forward to this conversation. And as we did our pre-call yesterday, I learned about some of your foray into AI, which was really not surprising to me, I guess, just given what I know about you. So I'm eager to take that up as part of our conversation. And so we'll have a discussion on asset prices, the dance between the markets and the economy and the Fed. All of these things are obviously so linked. And then, of course, we live in a world not of just disruption from an AI standpoint, but disruption from a WH standpoint. That's the White House. And unconventional policies, which love them or hate them, are certainly things you need to really, really follow. So before we get our conversation underway, just tell us a little bit about Goose Hollow, your founding of it, what you're trying to accomplish on behalf of your investors, and also mention your ETFs as part of that as well.
We started Goose Hollow about 5 years ago, mostly because we thought at that time that we needed a slightly different approach to markets. And I had been at several large hedge funds and seen how it's done. So we started with mostly institutional clients, managing SMAs for them. And then about 3 years ago, we launched a couple of ETFs. So we have one ETF, it's a tactical fund called GHTA. And then we have another fixed income ETF as well called GHMS. The approach to markets here is that we're indifferent about looking at asset classes. So we go across equities, fixed income, currencies, commodities, and we have a very global lens to it. To give you an example, if you think platinum is going to do well, we're looking at South Africa where platinum is produced. We are looking at platinum metal itself. We're looking at platinum miners. And so we sort of look at it from a 360-degree view, and we start with the top-down idea generation. And then we try to see which asset class best fits the expression of the idea.
Awesome. Well, there's so much going on. And I think for the purposes of our conversation, while we could go far and wide, I think let's focus in on the U.S. economy to start and get your take on some combination of what you see in the data right now, both from a growth and inflation standpoint, and where you see that going. As a precursor, of course, we see certain signs of a labor market that's stalling out. Some part of that might be difficulty in measuring the data. And then we see inflation not necessarily rising in any way like it did in 2022, but perhaps the progress on it has certainly leveled off, at least on the consumer price index side of things. Give us your take. Where do you see the U.S. economy right now from a growth standpoint? And then also give us your read on the inflation side as well.
On the U.S. economy, before we get into the details of it, I think from a macro perspective, I think we're in this phlogiston moment. You might recall in the 18th century, the scientists used to explain combustion using this phlogiston theory. And it was a very neat and self-consistent idea, but it turned out to be totally wrong until Lord Kelvin came along and showed that there was some other way combustion actually happens. So if you take the U.S. economy, for instance, and then look at how we're looking at what's driving it and so on, the first and foremost thing most people would argue is that consumption is the primary driver of the U.S. GDP. But if you look at this year, consumption has actually slowed down dramatically. Consumption is now 0.8, 0.9% compared to where it was, say, last year or the year before. So consumption has been slowing down dramatically. At the same time, investment, and especially AI-related investment, has been picking up. So we have this shift away from consumption to the investment side. So we have the right data, but I know there's been a lot of arguments recently about the BLS and the data that we're getting and so on. I think the framework has to be updated because if you think of it from a macro perspective, most people still focus on the consumption side. And that makes sense because 70% of the economy is consumption. But the investment side is now going to get much bigger. And that's partly due to some of the things you mentioned, what's happening with tariffs and where the consumer is at the moment, and the backdrop of AI as well. So for all these reasons, what we see at the moment is a shift away from consumption towards investments.
In terms of how you set that up with regard to perhaps needing the framework updated and maybe not looking at it the right way, is a shift away from consumption towards investment, is that a good thing? We certainly have CapEx booms and busts. We don't really have consumption booms and busts. It's a little bit more consistent. How should we think about just analyzing the economy now versus, I don't know, 8 to 10 years ago when this CapEx boom was not such a thing?
First and foremost is that we start worrying about a recession as soon as, say, retail sales or some of these macro indicators start to slow down. Or you look at housing starts or new home sales. Many of these things have been flattish to down, while at the same time, the market's making new highs and the economy overall, people are all close to full employment for the most part. So part of the thing we need to think about is that the consumption being the stable driver of GDP, that was the old phlogiston belief, right? And that has changed now. You remember there was this whole theory around the Phillips curve. And inflation follows the Phillips curve, and if you get low employment, unemployment, you get high inflation. So we've had periods where we've had low unemployment, and we've had inflation falling down, and then we've had high rising core inflation, even though job growth's slowing down. So there is a lot of the macro frameworks that we look at the markets have to be updated. And it goes back to what you said before, which is, if you have this extra factor, which is the president of the United States having a view on companies, on macro data, on Fed chairman, on all sorts of things that otherwise the president wouldn't weigh on, that means that you have like a new factor in terms of how you think about markets and policy. And I think that's something that we need to update from how we used to do things previously.
When you think about the CapEx part of this, underpinning so much of the performance of these mega cap stocks, and probably a lot of ancillary benefit to non-mega cap stocks as well, it's just this behemoth. How do you see that playing out? Is there a point at which the show me the money becomes a little bit more of the decision-making process? In other words, we have put all this money into data centers and building out this capacity. And we're seeing clearly some really cool and compelling stuff. We also want to see return on investment as well. From your perspective, does this cycle have many more years of legs at its current level? How should we think about that CapEx cycle, just given how important it is for the economy and the markets?
If you think about the MAX 7 spending for this year, it's supposed to be at $400 billion this year. In terms of overall CapEx, AI CapEx is up 50% compared to last year. And rest of the non-residential CapEx is basically flat. So most of the CapEx we're seeing is related to AI and AI-related things. And if you look at overall CapEx spend, IT CapEx is now like 25% of overall CapEx, which is all-time highs. So we're spending a lot of money. I saw something about $7 trillion over the next 5 years across major developed economies for AI-related investments. So that's a pretty big number in terms of CapEx spend. But the problem with this is this sort of CapEx is very capital intensive. The whole AI boom, it requires a lot more capital than labor. So the number of actual jobs being generated from this is much smaller. If anything, we're trying to replace labor by doing this. So if you take Elon's word on us having 1 billion humanoids, you know, that means we're going to need a lot less labor if that actually would come about. So the nature of this CapEx boom is quite different. And it also means that the beneficiaries of that is also like a smaller subset. So the AI-related efficiencies, they've only gone to few sectors within the economy. A lot of the other sectors in the economy haven't really benefited from this CapEx yet. And if you go back and look at other technological cycles, or even if you even look at something like the gold rush, obviously we are in the pick and shovel stage of the gold rush. We still haven't found gold yet, and we are still in that stage. And that's why if you see the market performance as well, many of the companies that have done really well are the ones selling picks and shovels. So companies selling compute, GPUs, all of that, the hyperscalers. So they are the ones that have gone up the most. The actual productivity gain, we haven't seen it. It might take a while. So it might be, we did all the cables that we lay down during the TMT bubble. That was in the late 90s. And the internet really didn't take off till like 2010s. There was a period of where you did all this massive investment and nothing really changed. And so we might have a similar situation with this CapEx boom we have. Now, the problem I see with this is historically, whenever we've had such a big overinvestment boom in any technology, we cannot control ourselves and we end up overinvesting. So we saw that in the telecom boom in the 90s, the shale oil boom in the 2010s, the same story. You know, we were so excited about it and we were investing so much, and then oil prices collapsed and shale oil is still with us, but it's not the same story anymore. So I think there is a good chance that we are over-investing at the moment in a lot of these things. And also, AI is a very loose word. People use AI to mean different things. So most people, when they say AI, they think of LLMs, which is these language models. I think of them more as like stochastic parrots. They're good at pattern recognition and a few things, but they're not really AI as in real intelligence. But there are so many other things within AI where not much money is going at the moment because a lot of focus is on getting the LLM stuff to work and get them to reason and all that sort of stuff. We might also be over-investing within AI in technologies that may not really give us AGI or whatever the big end game on this is. There's multiple issues with this AI CapEx boom. One is obviously at some point, because it's a disruptive technology, we could get something that replaces NVIDIA's GPU. So it could be a Huawei chip or some other company in Korea or elsewhere, or even here, somebody could come up with something that replaces GPUs. And then you've got massive amounts of spend on GPUs. All of that would have to be depreciated quite dramatically in a very short period of time. So that's a risk really with the CapEx boom. And the other side of it is that if AI is always good enough for 80% of the task. And the last 20%, it's not able to quite get there. And then that's been the nature of many of these technologies for the last two decades that I've been using machine learning. It's always, it's good enough, but not perfect. We're in that point. It also creates a problem where we are using AI in a lot of our investment process in terms of automating, reporting, and lots of other little things that we would otherwise do. But we don't feel confident enough to let it actually drive things because it can hallucinate, it can make mistakes. And as you know, in investments, we cannot have the AI do something that we cannot explain. So that's the other aspect of this whole technology. Some of the results that you would get, it's not easily explainable. So there is inherent limitations of LLMs and how far they can go, particularly even on the reasoning side of things. As soon as you start to explore it a little deeper, you see quickly that there's no theory of mind. They don't really understand things. It's more of a stochastic pattern. So I think where we come away from this is that the CapEx boom, obviously, at the moment, we're in the euphoria stage of this. And so this can go on for a period of time. But at some point next year, perhaps, we will have people asking questions on, okay, we are spending $400 billion on this thing, and what do we have to show for this? Now, obviously, the fact that my office and my Google Docs and Google Sheets and Word and Excel are all AI enhanced, that's great. But that's not really what people are looking for. People are looking for something that's going to really transform how they work. So the incremental efficiency, productivity boosts are great. That's not going to be enough to explain the amount of spending that we've done on this.
So a couple of things I want to ask you on this. One is just reflecting a little bit more on the CapEx cycle in light of the two previous examples that you gave, the shale revolution and then also the telecom investment cycle, and then also the implications from a employment standpoint. This is displacing from an employment standpoint, and consumption still remains a large part of the economy. What are the implications there? So let's first start with utilizing what you said about the telecom investment boom and bust and then shale. As I recall, both of those were considerably more debt financed. You had the unwind of debt as a function of both of those episodes of malinvestment. Certainly the shale energy credit unwind of 2015 was a significant thing. And then a lot of these telecom debt securities wound up not being money good. This feels considerably more equity funded. This is the rich companies, the richest companies who've got more cash than they know what to do with, pushing it at the CapEx cycle. I'm just curious if you could just reflect on what we can learn from those past two episodes and how we should think in light of what happened there, a little bit more about this cycle.
I think you're right. This is a bit different in the sense that we don't have Global Crossing and these sort of very highly levered companies doing things. So if you take a company like Meta or Google, they all make tons of money. So even though they're spending enormous amounts of money in GPUs and other infrastructure, it's not the same story. So it is very different in terms of how much cash a company like Meta is generating or Google is generating. And relative to that, how much are they spending on CapEx? If you see in the markets too, the credit markets at least, they're very cognizant of that. Spreads on these companies are still very tight. And of course, like you look at a company like CoreWeave, that trades at a more like a high yield name. So there is definitely some differentiation within credit markets on what you just said, which is a very valid point. So the unwind here is not the same. It's not like suddenly oil goes to $30 and all these shale companies are a zero. So that doesn't happen. What could happen is if you look at the multiples of these companies, for the most part, if you look at the equity rally since ChatGPT came out into the public domain, most of that rally could be explained by multiple expansion. Now, obviously, there is earnings growth. So I'm not like a bear. So we're making money, obviously, because nominal growth is 5-6%. With inflation, it was even higher. So companies are going to be making at least 10% earnings growth. So that is definitely there. But what is interesting is that multiple expansion we've had has been driven on the fact that AI will generate new sources of revenue and new markets and new expand TAM and so on for a lot of these companies. And that part, I'm not so sure. One other thing on this is, if I went back to the 1920s and I told you, like, hey, you know, there's this thing called the automobile, like a car that's come about, and you'd be like, okay, how many car companies are there? There were like a couple thousand auto companies at that point. It is very difficult for us to then say Ford Motor Company was going to be the winner, because most of those car companies disappeared in the next 5-10 years. But it was much, much easier to go back in time and say, okay, the car has come about. What is the thing that we're not going to use anymore? We're not going to use horse-drawn carriages. So oftentimes it's easier for us to find the disrupted part of that than the company that's going to be the winner on this. Clearly, like, we're going to have, not all of these companies are going to be winners. It's going to be one or two big winners. So my guess is OpenAI obviously has benefited from the ChatGPT name and the quick recall from consumers. It's become like a term, right? Oh, let's Google it. Let's ChatGPT it. So they obviously are going to be one of the winners on the consumer side. But on the enterprise side, and in terms of what actually happens in the bigger picture, it's unclear, because there is this big disconnect within AI between whether it's a technology like Microsoft Office, which everybody licenses and pays for and uses, or is it like an operating system, more like a Unix type thing, in which case you're going to basically have a commodity business. So these are two different things. So if it is a commodity business, then the open source models are going to compete with the closed source models. And then there is no real advantage. I mean, obviously now getting any of these foundational models done costs billions of dollars. So not many people can actually train these models anymore because it costs a lot of money. But if you take on the inference side, once you have a model, if it's open source, you could run it on your own infrastructure. And so that kind of changes what the economics of this looks like. So there's multiple aspects of it. Obviously, there's going to be AI native applications. Just like on the iPhone, we have apps. It's going to be something like that for the AI boom as well. And then you're going to have the consumer side of AI, which at the moment looks like OpenAI is going to win on that one. But it's unclear to me what happens on the overall enterprise layer, whether people use these models that we have now or the open source ones get better and better and people prefer to use that. That's still unclear.
One question I keep wrestling with, and maybe I just don't know enough about it, is the incredibly low correlation among these stocks. It's very, very different than the tech boom 25 years ago. Intel to Cisco to Microsoft, they were 70 to 75% correlated in terms of their daily return profile. Meta to Amazon to Google to Nvidia to Microsoft, extremely low correlation, sometimes zero for periods of time. Microsoft to Nvidia was a zero for a couple of months there. And it just strikes me, I know that they're different businesses in some ways, but they are all pursuing something very similar. And I just wonder if, I don't know if that's a blind spot for investors or if it's easily explained. How do you size up the very low level of correlation among these stocks?
At the moment, the market's not as focused on what the AI investments are leading to. There's no questions on what are the gains and so on, because we're still trying to work out how this new layer will operate. So for instance, if you have ChatGPT and OpenAI, how are they going to monetize that? They're not going to show ads, supposedly. So how will they monetize that whole the eyeballs they've got? Depending on that, others might have to react as well. So imagine OpenAI goes down the path where they allow you to order a toaster oven. You ask OpenAI, like, hey, I'm buying in a toaster oven, and then it recommends a product, and then they get paid based on the recommendation. Now, that's very different, say, from how things work right now. So you go on Google and you search, and Google shows ads and monetizes those ads. And so that whole thing is happening as well. So it's still, I think, very early stages on the how much is AI helping me face. If you even listen to company earnings calls, most of them are talking about various aspects of how their businesses are benefiting from AI. But there is no like actual dollar number assigned. Okay, because of AI, we've had this amount of increase. Or only company where I see a lot of attribution is Meta, where they've changed the way you can create ads using AI and done a lot of other things using AI for their overall product. So I think that might explain why on a day-to-day basis, we're not seeing much correlation. The other aspect of it is if you take NVIDIA and say some of these other names, NVIDIA has been more of a macro story in terms of Jensen being able to sell chips to China, not being able to sell chips to China, and so on. Like, that's been driving NVIDIA more than the actual NVIDIA as a business. They just make money. They print money because there's huge demand for the GPUs, and they can't give everybody GPUs who wants it at the moment. So that's kind of partly, I think, explains this lack of correlation. I think where we will see the increase is when you get like a DeepSeek moment. So if you go back to April and you look at the correlation around that time, that would look much more correlated, because what happened when DeepSeek came about was, A, of course, now we have an open source model that was supposedly trained for tens of millions of dollars. They created this model. And two, they used the older GPUs, not the state-of-the-art GPUs, that were limited in many ways as well. So then the question was, do you really need a Blackwell and the new fancy GPUs? So all of that came together, and we got this kind of a decline in many of these companies at the same time. So I think like there is that. And then even there, the market wasn't very discerning, because if you say that there's going to be very cheap inference, so inference costs go down, because if you have open source LLMs that are really good and you can run them on commodity hardware, like say an ASIC, Bitcoin now, you know, they have ASICs that are very cheap. So you can do the mining with those ASIC chips. We will get some ASICs, and many companies here are developing that. And if that comes about, Meta would actually benefit from it, because they actually use a lot of AI in their workflow. So although they have Llama, which is an open source model, for the most part, inference getting cheaper is good for Meta, because they're actually a user of AI. And you could say that about Microsoft also, because ultimately Microsoft is selling Office and other things, and they're using AI more than actually selling their own AI models. So if you look at many of the Microsoft AI models like Phi and other things, they're actually open weights and open source, so you can actually use it. So I think there is like a little bit of a differentiation there as well. Where I think we can see a lot of this coming together is probably later this year, early next year, even when the market starts to again think about the amount of CapEx that's happening. Particularly that CapEx also means it's going to be, if it's not all funded from earnings, and if companies' earnings kind of slow down a little bit and they still are doing enormous CapEx, then people will start thinking about the amount of debt and corporate borrowing and all that sort of stuff. At the moment, none of that is actually a consideration.
Microsoft, as you mentioned, there was a story about them laying off, I think, 6,000, might have been programmers. And of course, that's in some ways at the heart of the disruption, are those types of jobs. And that's where I wanted to shift to, is the labor market side of things, especially post that last NFP and the downward revisions. I'd love to understand how you think about the labor market side of things. And then specifically, of course, the Fed is zeroed in on that. So the assessment of the jobs aspect of the growth picture, and then how you think the Fed policy cycle is going to materialize from here.
It's multifaceted because, as you know, the labor market is impacted by not just AI, but a lot of other things going on as well. The first and foremost thing is that if you look at this technology, AI, LLMs, whatever you want to think about, and whenever I hear the word AI, I think of something much bigger. Then I have to come down to, oh, this is LLMs we're talking about. If you take AI as humanoids and other things that people are working on and put it all together, the difference between this technology disruption and the previous ones is that this time around, they're actually replacing humans. So if you take the steam engine or the car or any of the other great technological leaps we had, like the telegram or the telephones, all of that was helping us to communicate faster. And of course, it replaced some people, but not dramatically. Here, to some extent, a lot of the very simple jobs that we have could be automated, particularly if you get humanoids and these humanoids are getting better and better. That will also change the demand for labor. So that's clearly one thing. But the other side of the story on the labor market is that the labor market's already been slowing down because if you take the US economy, 70% is consumption. And we, unlike other countries, so if you take China, for instance, consumption is only 40% of total GDP in China. So we're a much bigger consumption basket. And the reason for that is we don't tax consumption. So we don't have a VAT tax or any kind of tax on consumption. If you go to Europe, UK, or even continental Europe, they all tax consumption. So consumption is a much smaller part of the economy. If you're going to tax consumption, that's going to slow your growth down a little bit, but also it'll cause labor demand to also fall. So that's partly also happening. So what we're seeing, I mean, and this is the same data that everybody else looks at, is that there's a general trend where labor demand is slowing down. And you can see that in the qualitative measures like JOLTS in terms of the quits rate and all these other things that people look at. And all of them are showing a very similar picture, which is the labor market's cooling down and slowing down. Now, the problem we have is that the data, as we found last month, and you know, there was a lot of hue and cry about it, but this is something we've known for a long time. The payroll itself is a survey, and the standard error of the survey is about 100,000 jobs. And then you take the birth, death adjustments and the seasonal adjustments, the real standard error of the estimate is between 150,000 to 175,000. So if you get like a payroll print of 200,000, we could have added anywhere from 0 to 400,000 jobs. That's what it really means because it's a sample estimate. What we have here is that we have a very not so precise measure of labor demand and how the labor market is doing. And that is the one that we're using to decide on things. Historically, at least, I don't know how it'll be this year, the seasonal adjustments and revisions to the birth death model changes the payroll numbers for the year by about 1 million jobs. So if you think about our economy, 350 million people or so, 330 million people or so, and the total working population, some fraction of that. So 1 million jobs is 1%, maybe a little less than 1% of the actual workforce. So it is kind of like a pretty big number. So we have slowing down in the labor market, but it's not clear how quickly we're going to see further deceleration there. The other thing I want to also point out is that in the most recent slowdowns, like in 2020 and the ones prior to that, what we saw was that unlike, say, 08, 09 or other historical recessions, labor demand didn't change by much. So people didn't actually hire and fire tons of people in a short period of time. Now, obviously, if you have temporary workers and working retail and everything shut down because of COVID, of course, you got laid off. But for the most part, labor demand didn't fluctuate as much. So there's much more stickiness to the employment picture. That also means that now if companies feel that they're getting this big productivity boost and they could automate a lot of stuff with AI, that we could get an opposite effect where a lot of them might actually decide that they need less labor at the same time. because this is something that we noticed, is that companies are much more correlated and consistent in thinking. Like, they all seem to want to hire people at the same time. So we saw in 2020, soon after the COVID crash, there was a massive demand for labor. So that was 2020 into 2021. And now we might be seeing the other side of the cycle. And of course, tech is the front line of all this. So that's where we're going to see the first impact. But then slowly, perhaps it goes into other areas as well.
Let me ask you, on the monetary policy response to this, you have the growth side, which some folks think we still haven't really appreciated the tariff impact. We've talked a little bit about the labor market. I want to first ask you just about Fed policy and interest rates and controlling the short end. In light of this new way of looking at things, which is very CapEx centric, it doesn't strike me that the Fed easing or tightening is going to impact Microsoft very much in terms of its CapEx. It's using its own money. You talked a little bit about perhaps not paying as much attention to things like housing, which everybody links to interest rate policy. It's more the back end than the front end. But how should we think about Fed policy, a potential easing cycle, if you think that's coming, and the degree to which that impacts the economy from a tailwind standpoint if we do get a bona fide easing cycle going?
One of the first things I want to mention is that if you go back in time and look at previous Fed easing cycles, it was quite different than this time around. First point is that, as you mentioned, the Fed tightened 400 basis points, 450 basis points, and nothing really happened to the economy. Nothing happened, as in growth slowed down a little bit, but it wasn't like, you know, everything came crashing down or things that people were worried about that didn't quite happen. So you had like a repricing of very long duration assets in 22. Then everything kind of recovered once we got to like an equilibrium interest rate. The interest sensitivity of the economy, particularly the front end, seems very low. I mean, if the Fed tightens 100 basis points, eases 100 basis points, I'm not sure it'll have a big impact on the economy as a whole. And for the reasons you mentioned, which is a lot of the economy is now being driven by investments that is AI driven, and those people are not deciding based on where Jay Powell sets interest rates in September. But stepping back, in terms of the Fed policy itself, the question we always ask is if, when, and by how much? Are they going to cut rates? When are they going to cut rates? And how much are they going to do? So I think the if part, I think they are clearly going to ease because we saw the recent data, and more recently, most of the Fed speakers have said that they would be open to cutting rates in September. So that's for sure. The question then is when. And of course, when could have been in July, but it's some reasons that data came a few days later. So now we have to wait till September for this cut. And then the how much part of it, that's where we are most focused on. So obviously, the market thinks there's a little more than 25 basis points of cuts priced in for September. But if you are actually easing because you think that inflation's coming down dramatically and the labor market's weakening as well, and you yourself have said that the neutral rate actually has come down quite a bit in the past. So it's possible that they start with a 50 basis point cut. It's just like when they hike. You remember they were hiking 50 a pop and then they switched to 25. So I could see them going 50 in September just to get things going. And then maybe they slow down to 25 a quarter. The market's currently assuming that in expectation, it's priced in about 3%. We get to like 3% by end of 26, which seems about right. But I'm just not sure on the path itself, in the sense that if you start with 50, then the market's going to completely reprice. If I told you, oh, the Fed just went 50, you, and I ask you, what are they going to do in December? You'll say they were again 50. Why would they just, unless they tell you, we're definitely not going 50, which they will not do. So I think the market can reprice the front end. So the way I think about it is that we are underestimating the number of cuts in the very near term, but also overestimating how much accommodation we're going to get from all this. So Will it be a surprise if they cut rates and some of the momentum stocks and Bitcoin and some of the other things don't actually go up, they actually go down? It will not surprise me because I don't think the correlation is quite there. It's like this same thing, like the phlogiston thing. You know, it's like we assume that interest rate cuts drive. If you go and look at research on equities, and one of the biggest macro driver of equities is the discount rate. Historically, that was the case. But here, to some extent, there will be an impact. So if they go like 200-300 basis points very quickly, okay, that will have an impact on equities. But what really matters is where they end up at. So I think that's where it's still unclear to me, because on the one hand, you could argue that the tariffs and all of this headwinds are going to create like a slowdown. Tariffs is a tax on consumption, and 70% of the economy is consumption, so the economy is slowing down. So then the Fed will actually react to that and cut rates a lot more. But if you get a scenario where the AI capex keeps the economy floating, and then the tariffs bring a lot of inflation, and then you have a picture where the Fed might actually have to turn around, maybe not even stop, but even talk about hiking again. So that could happen next year, potentially. So the scenario that some people have, which is sort of this deflationary, gloomy scenario, I don't quite see that given the underlying forces at work, but we have to keep an open mind. But our base case is for the Fed to cut rates more aggressively than what's priced in at the moment. And perhaps later this year, we start to see the impact of tariffs in the data. Last time around, when we had Trump in 2016, 2017, when they put tariffs on washing machines, it took about 3 months for the tariff to show up in the data. So the washing machine prices went up to 3 months. So we would probably expect the same here. Most of the tariffs have gone on this month, next month. So it'll probably be not till November, December that we see the actual data start to reflect that. Obviously, retailers and companies have front run the tariff a little bit and built inventory. So they're going to have to run that inventory down before they start raising prices. So that's kind of our view that in the near term, maybe there's more cuts and then the Fed then has to react to whatever comes after that.
During the July press conference, Powell, and arguing for, I guess what I would call the optionality of patience, was pointing to a labor market that he described as close to full employment. Now, I think that turns out to not be correct, but also arguing that patience was needed to learn more about the potential price impact of tariffs, which is what you're talking about. The dialogue seems to be about the extent to which the Fed can look through potential increases in prices as kind of one-off. Maybe it's a price level shift that just stays there. It's not inflationary in that sense. But as I think about their ability to do so, it's hard to get away from core PCEs at 2.7, I think, could be going up. I think Goldman has forecast 0.3 the next round. So we've really stalled out on making progress to 2%. It's not like we're losing the inflation battle, but we're certainly not progressing. And so as the market has got 5 cuts baked in, as you say, to the end of 2026, it's a tough one. It's a tough call for Powell. And then, as you also say, it's a tax. It's an impetus to growth from a consumption standpoint as well. So it's a tricky scenario. And all of this, and this is where I wanted to turn the conversation, which is just your overview of how you look at risk premiums. And what I mean by that, whether it's credit spreads, options, the vol surfaces of various asset classes, the MOVE index is below 80 now. You got to go back to before the tightening cycle to get there that low. VIX has certainly been lower, but it's come down a ton post the tariff uncertainty in August. What do you see in the landscape of option prices that has you interested? Is anything incongruous to the risks that you see? Are there trade constructions that really carry well? Give us your take on the wonderful world of option prices.
We could talk about that for a long time, but from a super big picture, if you take equity markets, so obviously, as you know, the equity volatility itself, realized volatility has been coming down And so that has been driving flights down. And I think this will continue for a period of time, because what we are seeing is kind of a broadening of the actual rally. So you're seeing different sectors start to work. You noticed in the last week or so, the home builders are starting to behave better, because suddenly, you know, you've got a potential for rates to come down dramatically. So that might help the home builders. So they're starting to go up. So there's a definitely like a rotation happening, and that keeps overall correlations down. And so the volatility as well is down on the very near term. But if you think about the picture like a little further out, if you do get these tariff-driven slowdowns, so we can get one of two things. I mean, there are three things actually that can happen, but in my mind, two are primary things. One is you get like a growth slowdown and inflation also comes down with it. Well, if you got a growth slowdown, then S&P earnings are not going to be growing at 10% next year. People have top-down estimates of about 10% earnings growth. So that's not going to happen. And then you'd also get the multiple compression, right? So it's a thing where the market tends to expand multiples when the S&P is going up and earnings are actually growing handsomely, and then also compresses multiples. So we would see that. So we could get a fairly large decline purely from an earnings perspective. Now, if you get the other scenario where the economy is okay, we're slowing down, but not dramatically, but inflation really has picked up, then what we're going to get is we might get like a reaction in the bond market, and that will probably have an impact on multiples. So, you know, I'm not saying we'll see 2022 again, but it'll be a similar thing that can play out on that. The third scenario, which I think seems less likely, and I could be totally wrong on this, is where the economy chugs along and inflation doesn't really go up by much. I have a hard time seeing that, because I see the consumer, I mean, apart from the very wealthiest cohort, the rest of consumer have run down their savings. So any sort of incremental increase in prices will be meaningful to them. Also, the other aspect of this is, if you take the washing machine case, so you had tariffs on washing machines, so it's not like a item that I'm buying every month. I haven't replaced my washing machine in 10 years, so I don't even know the prices went up 15%. But if you take the current tariffs, there's such a large number of goods across a variety of things that we consume that we're going to see some impact of the tariffs. I think this is more of a behavioral thing. Like, even if you're selling a good that isn't being impacted from tariffs, if you see other prices going up, you're quite tempted to increase prices, because your costs of consumption, your own consumption has cost you more money. So you're going to try to increase your prices as well. So I think we'll see like a little bit of a ripple effect from the tariffs. It'll be a one-off thing, but, you know, it'll lead to a delayed reaction. And then this is what we saw, the previous inflation shock, the very recent one after COVID, where there was a supply disruption and car prices went up and all sorts of consumer durable prices went up. What we saw with the auto side was, as soon as auto prices, car prices, used car prices, all of this stuff went up, 2 years later or 18 months later, insurance prices also went up with a lag, because the cost of insuring those things also went up. So we're going to see something similar here, where the tariffs are going to happen, and then soon after, we're going to see a delayed impact on other parts of the economy as well.
One of your areas of focus, among many, is emerging markets. And I think there's a particular interest in allocations to some of the non-US assets. I'd love for you to walk through that thesis there and how you're implementing it.
On EMs, I mean, you know, I like to say this, like, every year the best performing equity market is an emerging market country, and the worst performing is also an emerging market country, right? So that's always the case. But this year, if you look at it, most of them have outperformed quite dramatically. I'm comparing them to the S&P 500. And I think it's got to do with three reasons. So from an EM perspective, the things that are really good for them is when inflation is coming down and the dollar is going down. When that happens, their interest rates are coming down. And because the bonds, you know, other fixed income instruments in EM are starting to perform, you get a lot of flows into those countries. And so you get this self-fulfilling effect where you get more flows, which then drives interest rates further down, and then that appreciates their currency, unless the central bank's trying to stop the appreciation by intervening, which most of them have shied away from because there's a lot of focus on exchange rate policy in the current administration. So you get this like very good self-fulfilling positive feedback loop where you have that going this year, which is inflation has been coming down and the dollar also has been going down. So that is the primary driver. Now, the secondary driver is that all of this CapEx we are doing here, and this is just not us, in other countries as well. So if you take Europe, I mean, Europe's maybe not spending as much money on AI, but they're definitely spending a lot more money on defense. Same in Japan and Korea and other countries. So all of that leads to demand for commodities. And a lot of EMs export commodities. So if you take Brazil, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, in most of these LATAM countries, they have a lot of resources. And so they benefit from the whole CapEx boom that we are having, because this CapEx boom, like in order to build the data centers, we need tons of energy, and we also need copper and other materials, metals. And so that is also a driver for EM this year. So the way we've been thinking about EM is we've been focused on emerging markets that are not in the crosshairs in the US-China conflicts. So avoiding China. We had some China earlier this year, but we've kind of shied away from it at the moment. And we are more focused on countries in this region. So if you think about like us going into like a tripolar world where the US dominates this region, China dominates Asia, and Europe's contested between Russia and France and Germany, there could be a lot more tighter integration of trade flows just within this region. And so we've been much more focused on LATAM countries. So we like the currencies in many of these countries, and we also like the equity markets. Even in fixed income, if you look at places like Brazil, the policy rate is at 14%. Real interest rates are quite high, depending on a backward-looking inflation or forward inflation is between 5-6% real interest rates. So you're really getting paid to own fixed income in these countries. And the beauty of this is if inflation does come down here and the tariffs aren't as big a deal, EM will benefit a lot more because their real interest rates are much higher and those would come down quite a bit and nominal rates also will come down. So that makes it super interesting to look at those countries. So if you take Brazil, there are banks in Brazil that trade less than book value. And the best part of this is if interest rates go from, say, 14% to like 10% or 9%, which Brazil had 6-7% rates not too long ago, so you could easily see a scenario where that happens, these banks will literally double in value. Because in emerging markets, when interest rates go down, it's more of a credit story. So the credit of everybody in the economy improves because they can all repay their loans. And so the banks do really well. So we like some of the banks in emerging markets, and that's something we've been very focused on.
Last question. So we've had, in the last couple of years, three significant, what I will just call equity vol events. You can go back to 2022. We'll exclude the pandemic. That's such a giant one-off global unwind. But 2022, you had a tightening cycle. The VIX got as high as, I want to say, 36. 2024, we had a pretty random, just about a year ago, massive spike in the VIX that was some part of an unwind of exposure between dollar yen. And then this year, we had this tariff tantrum that got the VIX north of 40, even 50, it closed at. If I told you the VIX got to 40 and stayed above 30 for 2 weeks or so, what's your best guess on what happened? If it's at some point going forward, what are the things that keep you up at night from a left tail perspective?
So this is a very good question, Dean. And we think a lot about it. And it's a very long list of things. So start with Russia. So the Russians, obviously, they're not happy with what happened in Ukraine, but they're not going to stop with the Ukraine. They could probably go to Finland or to the Baltics, and that could happen. And then that could happen later this year. you could have a scenario where there's a much more state-directed capitalism here. So like we put export taxes on AMD and NVIDIA. There's been a bill last year, that the last administration, there was a bill that was floating that was going to tax capital flows coming into the country. So imagine we turned up tomorrow and they said, oh, we're going to tax all capital flows coming into the country. I mean, how will that factor in? And then you have scenarios like, from a super big picture, a lot of the thinking one has to do now is about the enormous amount of debt every country has and how they're going to finance it and how is that going to play out. So if you take the scenario that's playing out in Japan and in UK and some other countries, they're slowly asking their pension funds to own more domestic securities. So UK is now asking UK pensions to own more UK stocks, because UK pension basically diversified away a lot and they own less than 5% in actual UK listed companies. There is that. So we could get a similar situation here where if the bond market has a problem at some point, we could get UK control and then we could also put like a tax on outflows. If you're a US investor investing overseas, you could be taxed. This is a new world we live in and all of these things can happen. So there is a lot of these sort of things that we think about and consider, but it's not easy to handicap them. For instance, like Russia's case, we had so many things that told us that Russians were up to something. The US government came out and said, they're moving their troops and they're going to be doing this. I was talking to one of the foremost experts on foreign policy, experts on Russia, right before this happened. And he said to me, yeah, he's going to go, but he's not really going to go all the way. So even though we have these things in our consciousness, in terms of what actually happens, it's really hard to put your finger on it. So there's a lot of other things like that that we think about. But from a market risk point of view, we are still leveraging. VIX is coming down, but it's not really low enough where you start worrying about potential for endogenous shocks. If you look at CTA positioning, if you look at systematic positioning, it's just starting to build up. So I think maybe by the time we get to September, we'll have the more fully positioned market where surprises could be much more meaningful. At the moment, all the adults are at the beach. It's the Mickey Mouse market. So all these stocks that are going up in all these things like marijuana and this and that, it's not the adults market yet. I do see a volatility event later this year, but at the moment, given the economy is in a steady state, the central bank's actually going to be cutting rates, it's hard to get too excited about volatility at the moment. Famous last words.
Yeah, no, it's a hard one to carry. You mentioned it. Realized vol is low. It's not as if these things are a steal. And I asked that question in light of one of my favorite sayings I've come up with, which is, risk management suffers from a failure of our imagination. You really do have to force yourself to just entertain wayward scenarios. Things can go wrong. It's not to mean that you can't go forward and keep investing. And you certainly could really hurt yourself loading up on very, very low delta options that don't pay off. But I just wanted to get some of your thought process on that. Chris, it's been a wonderful conversation. I'm glad we had a chance to catch up again, and I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy hearing your insights and your framework for thinking about risk and opportunity. So thanks again.
Thanks, Gene. Really excited to join you this time.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again and catch you next time.